The date is October the 11th, 1983. This is the sixth lecture in a series of lectures by Roger Ware on the Enlightenment. Tonight's lecture is entitled Voltaire, Who Lived 1694 to 1778, the famous voice of man freed from obscurities.
The best way to begin with Voltaire is to begin with 10 lines that he wrote to Jean-Jacques Rousseau, August 30th of 1755. He said, "I have received, sir, your new book, Against the Human Species, and I thank you for that. You will please people by your manner of telling them the truth about themselves, but you will not alter them. The horrors of that human society, from which in our feebleness and ignorance we expect so many consolations, have never been painted in more striking colors. No one has ever been so witty as you are in trying to turn us into brutes. To read your book makes one long to go on all fours." So we have a live wire on our hands. The difficulty with Voltaire is his exuberance. And we have been following along with Ernst Cassirer in the philosophy of the Enlightenment. And his contention was that no one had done more than Voltaire to dismantle the structure of understanding that had preceded him, stone by stone. He was born in 1694, and by the time he died in 1778, the entire face of Europe was changed. The simile that Cassirer uses is that of a river whose restraining dam has broken, and the dynamic of the waters pushing its way, jostling, recreating the landscape, and leaving a new Europe in its wake. And this river was a belief in the power of reason, and the Enlightenment, as we have seen, was concerned with a change of mind. We talk about different epochs or different decades, different phases of culture, or even more glibly, civilization. But the Enlightenment was a sea change. It was a permanent change of form of the mind of Western man. And the Enlightenment was the culmination of what had begun somewhat naively in retrospect in the Renaissance. And by the time of Leibniz and Newton, as we have seen, the very ways in which formulations of reality were placed before the inquiring nature of man were markedly different. It was a different species. This enormous volcanic upheaval came first in the personalities of the gifted, but by the end of the 18th century we'll see how it has permeated all of society, so that it was inevitable for the American revolutions, the French revolutions, the tremendous upheavals that ushered in the Industrial Revolution. And the stage has been set for us as we have followed the career of the development of the thought from Ficino up through Newton and Leibniz. We saw how steadily a major polarization of the European mind happened between England and Germany, how the individual of eccentric genius seemed to flourish in the English psychic subsoil, and how, contraposed to that, the German mind seemed to seek a collective fraternity, a brotherhood, a group. And these traits carry even on into the late 19th, early 20th century. One has, for instance, the artistic genius standing out in England of someone like Turner, and one has in Germany the phenomenon of the Bauhaus, of a group of people working together. This was characteristic of the German and English minds, and the fact that the German and English developed together. The French mind had been outside of this tandem growth. And by Voltaire's time, he was rebelling against the fact that France seemed to still have a medieval culture ruled by a Catholic hierarchy. And Voltaire liked nothing better than to dismantle the biblical physics that through its web-like speculation seemed to put a dampener upon the French mind. Voltaire many times would point to the exquisite exactness of the writings of Locke or Newton and the fine-spun trash of Descartes. Voltaire, in coming into the world, in fact, seemed to be destined from birth to be an iconoclast. His real father is somewhat a problematical historical issue. Voltaire himself did not consider Monsieur Arouet, who ostensibly was his father, to be his real father. He considered his father to have been some person in the military, and as a consequence, even though Voltaire's natural mother lived until he was 7 years old, he never mentioned her. He instead, as a youngster, he had come into the world in a very precarious way. In fact, his whole birth has a mystery about it. For many, many generations, it was listed as November 21st, but Voltaire, in some of his own writings, cites the fact that he was born in February 20th, 1694, and that his birth had been kept a secret for 7 months. In fact, in his own recountings, he says he was given up for dead. He was left at the bedside in a pan, and it was only due to the insistence upon an old abbé named Chateauneuf, who ran up and began trying to care for this scrawny, underweight infant. And Voltaire, in some psychic way, found an affinity with this old roué with a heart of gold and chose for his model of adult intelligence this Abbé Chateauneuf. So that when he was 6 or 7 years old, he already prided himself on being able to sing risque songs in Latin and to be able to make fun and ridicule in several Greek phrases. And the young Voltaire came into the world with these kinds of cynical teeth shining very bright. We have a portrait of the 24-year-old Voltaire looking very forthright and somewhat mischievous, and yet underneath it all, a tremendously capable intellect. He was made for the age of reason. He was made for the Enlightenment and was literally raised from the cradle to be the great urban knight errant of the new mind. He was scheduled to be a lawyer and sent to study, but of course Voltaire was unable to keep himself into a serious professional mode. His secret desire was to be a playwright, and in fact wrote a number of plays as a young man. Most of them were flops, most of them poked fun, and occasionally he got very close to the bone of someone high up, and we'll see that several times in his young life he was sent to the Bastille for offending the wrong people. And at one occasion, when he was 23 years old, he was sent to the Bastille for a full year for, hopefully, corrective measures upon his mind. All of this, all of the abrasion of his life and of his time only served to file him sharper. Voltaire becomes, in fact, the hero of the man who refuses to be bent or caged or corralled by any forms other than those of his own choosing. In fact, the young Voltaire, after coming out of the Bastille, decided that his best bet was to position himself in terms of an independent fortune and set upon learning business endeavors. And Voltaire built up in the course of his lifetime one of the great vast fortunes of the 18th century. It is true that he received certain pensions and stipends. When his father died, he received the equivalent of 4,000 francs a year. And because of certain poems that he wrote and favored by royalty, he received other stipends of several thousand francs per year. But the fact is this is paltry next to the funds that Voltaire made himself through his business acumen. He was an exceedingly sharp businessman. For a 20th century equivalent, I can only think of Howard Hughes or J. Paul Getty. Voltaire once cornered the market in a very special way and came out with more than a half million francs. So he was an extraordinary genius in terms of finances. But his roving pen and his mind made enemies for him in friends of the court who were more traditional and conservative in their ways. And it's very peculiar that his first learning of the English language came from a Tory conservative Englishman who was in exile from England, a man well known to history, Lord Bolingbroke. And in his exile in France, he was able to teach the young Voltaire enough English so that after coming out of his Bastille sentence at age 23, Voltaire went to England and spent 3 years in England. And while he was there, he met all of the great minds of the English Enlightenment. He was there to make the acquaintance of Newton, and in fact, Voltaire was present at the great death march for Newton. Newton, of course, had become the national hero of England in the Enlightenment. In order to form a just mythical image, Newton in the Enlightenment in England was like the King Arthur of the late 19th, early 20th century in the English psyche. He was the image of the great English man in the universe. And of course, Newton seemed to Voltaire to be just the epitome of the great man. In fact, his whole emphasis on the possibility of the human mind achieving superhuman capacities was based upon his acquaintance with Newton. He also met Swift, who wrote Gulliver's Travels, who was on visit from Ireland in London. He met Pope, the great poet. And in fact, the young Voltaire at this time, in his 20s and early 30s, felt a tremendous responsibility on himself to be the Virgil of the French civilization of the Enlightenment. And patterning himself upon the Aeneid, he wrote a tremendous epic called the Henriad, which was based on the life of Henry IV, who had waged wars of freedom of religion. And this tremendous poem, which was banned in France, many of Voltaire's greatest works were banned in France for most of his lifetime and well afterwards. But the Henriade was published in England, and it was dedicated at that time to Queen Caroline, and this brought Voltaire to the example of royalty throughout Europe as being a possible great mind, great literateur, so that later on in his life we will see that he adopts for himself as a conquering royal hero Frederick the Great, Frederick II of Prussia. And Frederick, of course, will take Voltaire in, and they will assume a position of ancient royalty, the king and his wise man. Voltaire is sort of the Enlightenment shaman of Frederick the Great. In England, Voltaire became a master of the English language and a master of the Enlightenment mind, and Cusser tries to bring out for us why it was that in England the Enlightenment, when it began, was such a bright guiding star for the rest of Europe. The only thing that I can think of in terms of comparison is the way in which at the early part of the 20th century the German mind was highlighted for us by the discoveries of Einstein. Many of us remember Einstein as a living figure, and we can recall the general popular feeling that he was the most intelligent man in the world, that someone was an Einstein if they were smart and brilliant to the nth degree. The English mind, honed to the apex of Newton, was exactly this image. Newton was the Einstein of his day. And in Newton, the Principia was so difficult to read. Its science, its mathematics, was a ferocious challenge to the ordinary person. So it's not surprising that the work of Newton that penetrated the English mind of the Enlightenment was not the Principia, but was the Optics. And the Optics went through three different editions in his lifetime, the last being the deathbed edition. And the Optics, of course, has as its central image the prism, which takes natural sunlight coming in, white sunlight, and diffracts it into a rainbow whose parts can be measured. So that the genius of Newton was that here was the mind of man that no longer took nature qua nature. It was no longer just natural, but coming through the prism of the enlightened mind, nature divulged all of its secrets. Someone wrote once that it was like the case of a virgin, nature having guarded her secrets for so long, suddenly opened her doors to everyone. And in the chaos that followed, almost anything was possible. So it was the Optics of Newton that permeated the popular mind. And in this permeation, it broke the natural circle, the mystical circle of Hermetic understanding that had obtained at least since the 12th century. Two wonderful studies have been done of this. The first, called The Breaking of the Circle, by a fine woman named Marjorie Hope Nicholson, studies in the effect of the new science upon 17th century poetry. And then the follow-up to this that she wrote, published in the same series that Cusser's Rousseau, Kant, and Goethe was published, the History of Ideas series at Princeton. The book is called Newton Demands the Muse, Newton's Optics and the 18th Century Poets. And in here, Ms. Nicholson is able to draw out hundreds of passages from poems which have largely been forgotten in our time now, but showing what a penetrating effect on the human imagination in England, Newton's differentiation of nature had been. This is one example here, just to give you, this is from Richard Savage, a long poem called The Wanderer. I have to give you a little background here. The Wanderer is a play on one of the earliest Old English poems called The Seafarer, which is at the very beginnings of English poetry. Ezra Pound in our time did a wonderful translation from the Old English of The Seafarer. You can find it in anthologies. In The Wanderer, Savage, the very name of the author itself seems almost significant, writes, "There lies obscured the ripening diamond's ray, and thence red branching corals rent away. In conic form there gilded crystal grows, and through such the palace lamp gay luster throws. Luster which through dim night as various plays, as play from yonder snows the changeful rays, for nobler use the crystal's worth may rise, if tubes perspective hem the spotless prize. Through these the beams of far lengthened eye measure known stars and new remoter spy." So that the character of the universe had cracked and some new form had born. And in this birth, the vertigo of disorientation, of dissociation, produced a kaleidoscopic sense of possibility. So that while some were suffering from a fear of the abysses of new possibility, Voltaire picks on his own countryman Pascal, who had written, "These infinite spaces frighten me." And Voltaire says, "This is petty. We can't have this. Man is not to be cowering under the table of his own dirty habits. He's to get on the table and shout. There's something new to have." And so in this tremendous press, what seemed to be the fulcrum was the mind of Sir Isaac Newton. When one looked for the culprit, or when one looked for the taproot, it was Newton. But in particular, it was the mind of Newton. So that these lines from Thomson's Seasons, Spring, written in 1727, the year that Newton died, "Meantime, refracted from yon Easter cloud, bestriding earth, the grand ethereal bow shoots up immense, and every hue unfolds in fair proportion, running from the red to where the violet fades into the sky. Here, awful Newton, the dissolving clouds form, fronting on the sun thy showery prism, and to the sage-instructed eye unfold the various twine of light by thee disclosed from the white mingling blaze." In other words, the mind of man had informed the eye of man into a new order. And the order no longer was a hermetically sealed, twined unity, but was just the exact opposite. It was the unity frayed. But each element of the fray had a set proportion and place, and that the new scientific rational mind of European man had the optimism to feel that if he could but count the strands and label them and make the relations, he could spin anew a unity of even grander importance. This, of course, was seen as something that could be done this year. We have not yet, by 1983, even begun to close this grand task, although science in our time still has this 18th century optimism that we may count the atoms and the cells and then know from that. In this, Cassirer writes, Voltaire marks a new epoch in France, not through his creative writings or his first philosophic essays, but through his defense of Newton in a book called The Elements of the Philosophy of Newton. The Elements of the Philosophy of Newton. And in this book, written in 1738, Voltaire declares that this is the crystal ball of the future, that all who wish to understand man, civilization, history, the mind, must gaze into this new set of proportions, into this prism, and learn to differentiate. But of course, the difficulty is that everyone has received the wrong education. Everyone has been prepared to accept blithely and blandly codifications and unities that no longer hold. And so what was wisdom before is now seen as naivete, the kind of naivete that could get us all killed, as someone once remarked. The difficulty is, as Voltaire points out, that the naivete extends to everyone, including the monarchs, who wage war for the old reasons, which are no longer sound, no longer valid. And so the basic thrust of Voltaire's life becomes a search for the right approach to influence the minds of the general populace, but especially royalty. The dedication of the Henriade is just one point and example. In fact, he became the favorite of Madame de Pompadour, the lady in the life of Louis XV. And she made sure that he was somewhat protected. He would have to flee Paris from time to time, but he would always be able to come back at specific dates and specific times. Later on, when this would prove a little too risque for Voltaire, he hit upon the perfect solution. He bought an estate exactly on the border of France and Switzerland, Ferney, so that when they came from either side, he could move to either side of the house. Voltaire never married, but the overwhelmingly vast love of his life was a wonderful woman, Madame de Châtelet, and I have drawings and illustrations of these people. Later on, you could, after the lecture, come up and see. She is a grand beauty. She was financially sound for herself, and Gabrielle fell in love with the young Voltaire, and they spent about 15 years of their life together. She was also an extraordinary intellect, and her favorite delving was to try to find the correlations between metaphysics and science. And it was because of her scientific bent that Voltaire wrote the great book on Isaac Newton. In fact, he had begun his love affair with England and wrote a volume called, in translation here, Letters on England, but in French it's Lettres Philosophiques. And in this, Voltaire gives us a précis of the English mind, that is, a quick overview to the insight to the detriment of the French mind. And the first person he lights on in here after he discusses the Quakers and Parliament and so forth is Sir Francis Bacon. And he says, we have never had this kind of a person in France. And Bacon was, in fact, the example of the truly great man. That the truly great man is not, he says, as Caesar or Alexander or Tamburlaine, but someone like Sir Francis Bacon, who changes civilization, who changes the nature of it. And another who came in this ilk, and even better, was Sir Isaac Newton. He compares here Newton to Descartes, and he writes, Descartes also affirms that volume alone makes matter. Newton adds solidity. And there you have some appalling clashes. This Newton, destroyer of the Cartesian system, died in March last year, 1727. He lived honored by his compatriots and was buried like a king who had done well by his subjects. People here have eagerly read and translated into English the eulogy of Newton by Monsieur de Fontenelle, delivered at the Académie des Sciences. In England, it was expected that the verdict of Monsieur de Fontenelle would be a solemn declaration of the superiority of English natural science. But when it was realized he compared Descartes with Newton, the whole Royal Society of London rose up in arms. And he goes on in the next letter to talk about the system of gravitation. And what Voltaire is getting at is a perspective that we have come to appreciate in our time. He writes, the discoveries of Sir Isaac Newton, which earned him such a universal reputation, concern the system of the world, light, infinity in mathematics, and finally chronology, with which he toyed for relaxation. I am going to tell you, if I can, without verbiage, the little I have been able to gather about all these sublime ideas. Then he says, the system of Descartes, interpreted and very much modified since his time, seemed to offer a plausible reason for phenomena. And this reason seemed all the truer for being simple and intelligible to all. But in natural philosophy, one should mistrust what one feels and understands too easily, just as much as the things one does not understand. And he goes on in this to tell us that what Newton has destroyed is not only the fairy-spun geometry theorizing of Descartes, but the theories of Leibniz. That Leibniz, with his ideas of the monad and of the notion that there are vortices around which reality seems to spin itself, have been clearly challenged by the development of English science under the banner of Newton. In letter 16 on the optics of Newton, Voltaire goes on to say that this sea change in the English mind has in fact prepared us for a new epoch in human understanding, and that the French must catch up with this. And in fact, he goes on to say, Newton has shown us that some of the classic beliefs of antiquity were fortuitous in the extreme. He says in here, in letter 16 and 17, that the ancient idea of the great Platonic year, for instance, is nothing but the procession of the wobbling of the Earth's poles, and that Newton has proved this. And so what was taken as a mystical pattern to all of antiquity, to the Greeks and Romans alike, actually has been shown in the Enlightenment to be exactly what it is. So Voltaire is tearing down, and at the same time he is preparing the ground for a new vision. But Voltaire is an iconoclast to the end. He will never conclude that vision. He will go out with his hands wide open, saying there is more yet to come. And so this quality of Voltaire seemed to find its epitome in letter 24 on academies. He says, the English had an academy of science long before us, but it is not as well regulated as ours, probably for the simple reason that it is the older. For if it had been established after the academy in Paris, it would have adopted some of its wise rules and perfected others. The Royal Society of London lacks the two things most necessary to men, rewards and rules. Now, for Voltaire, science is going to give us the rules. But we need to have a sense of sophistication to appreciate the rewards. And in this, Voltaire will dismantle the whole notion that a human being should organize themselves in a quiet way through penitence to achieve a sense of unity for themselves and harmonize that sense of unity with the grand tradition. He will instead insist that we need to extend the capacities for happiness, extend the understanding of nature and of man, and that therefore there is not so much unity but freedom and liberty that is needed. Liberty. But Voltaire will use these terms in a double sense always. He will say the old traditions have given us the liberty, as he says in Candide, to either run through the gauntlet of 2,000 soldiers 36 times and have them switch us, or we have the liberty to have the other choice, which is 12 lead balls in the brain through their muskets. He says, this is liberty. So the idea is that man has, instead of this ball of unity, he has opened up this funnel for capacity. And Voltaire is the great banner waver saying, man must be increasingly open, increasingly ready to change, and to use this change for his own happiness, whatever it might be. This, of course, would be a pure libertine background, except for the governor of the rules. And the rules come from empirical science. We must do this all in accord with the actual structure of the universe as we are able to understand it. That the rules and the liberty will go together and produce the new man. Cassirer, in the Philosophy of the Enlightenment, tells us that very often volumes would come out, like a volume by a man named Durham called Physical Theology. And he wrote another one called Astronomical Theology. And there was a theology of water and an insect theology. And these were attempts to try to take small handfuls of the scientific view and sift them according to old theological arguments and try and fit them in. Voltaire, of course, is out to destroy this entire set. And out of all the sciences at this time that seemed to bludgeon the old chronology most was the science of geology, because it seemed increasingly that the age of rocks completely transcended to the time scale that had been set, that if the creation of the universe had happened in 4004 BC, how can these rocks millions of years ago be extant? And increasingly, this kind of argument against the Bible occurs in Voltaire, and it occurs in him in a sarcastic and cynical mode. And in fact, Cassirer writes that his silence regarding the creation story was more eloquent than an open declaration of war could have been. For now, for the first time, a physical account of the world had been outlined which avoided religious dogmatism and claimed as its sole basis the observable facts and general principles of natural science. The stronghold of the traditional system had finally been breached, and Voltaire's busy mind did not rest until it had taken down the whole structure, stone by stone, in a work extending over more than half a century. Such demolition was the indispensable precondition for the new edifice of physics. For not until now had science, with full consciousness of the implications, taken up again the case against Galileo. And the vindication of Galileo was in the Enlightenment, and an indication that by virtue of this freedom, philosophy could attain to full self-knowledge and to knowledge of its inherent forces. So that Voltaire becomes the champion, I use the phrase, the knight errant of the Enlightenment mind. He composed a vast number of works, and coming down to us in our own time, one of the most popular was a work called Candide, written around 1758. And Candide is, in fact, a nice young man who is brought up and instructed by a certain Pangloss. And Pangloss is none other than Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz in fictive disguise. And he is attempting always to show that this is the best of all possible worlds. And of course, Voltaire is constantly showing the incredible happenings to Candide, and what cannot transpire, of course, is the confidence that there is a providence that has our best interest in mind. If this is the best possible world, it is for someone else other than man, and it carries over from Candide, I'll come back to that in a minute, to another work called Zadig. Voltaire loved to have exotic settings for some of his work. And this setting was in ancient Babylon. Voltaire would use Turkey, he would use Arabia, just as Montesquieu used Persia. These exotic settings were an attempt to take the European mind out of its habitual frame of reference and place it somewhere that it had not comfortably been before. In Zadig, we have, at the very beginning, the epitome of Voltaire's description of what had happened to himself and what had happened to man's mind in the course of the Revolution and the Enlightenment. He begins, he says, "In the reign of King Moabdar, there lived in Babylon a young man named Zadig, of naturally charming disposition, reinforced by education. Although young and rich, he knew how to control his passions, was unaffected, did not always want to be in the right, and was considered not to be frail. People were astonished to observe that despite his good sense, he never derided the loose, scrappy, noisy tittle-tattle, the reckless backbiting, the ignorant conclusions, the coarse quips, the empty tumult of words, which in Babylon were called conversation." So you get the tone of Voltaire here. It turns out that Zadig falls in love and is in turn loved by a beautiful young woman named Semir. And Semir, who loves Zadig very much, is seen one day by a scoundrel, a ruffian named Orkan. And Orkan attempts to have his way with Semir, with some of his friends. Zadig interferes, but is wounded by an arrow. And under one of his eyes, this tremendous abscess develops. And they send for one of the best physicians from Memphis in Egypt. And the physician declares that, in typical Voltaire fashion, had it been under the right eye, it could have been cured, but that abscesses under the left eye can never be cured. And Voltaire says the populace just was in awe over the medical acumen of the Egyptian. But the unbelievable occurrence is that Zadig survives, and the abscess ruptures, and his eyesight comes back. He goes looking for Samir, and he finds that she was psychologically unprepared to marry a one-eyed man, and so instead she decided that she would marry Orkan. So this is the kind of twist that Voltaire puts in his works. He's saying nothing is right. The old myths don't work anymore. That the only reason they worked before is that we were naive. We were coddled. And as long as we were patting each other on the back, it seemed that we were having a ritual of wholeness. But as soon as anyone breaks this chain of self-congratulatory innuendo and looks up to see what actually is going on, the whole show falls apart. Candide, of course, is the classic character rather than Zadig, and Candide is constantly being exposed to the fact that his being brought up in this beautiful castle, his young lady Cunegonde goes through a whole series of mishaps. He goes to the Americas, and Candide goes through all kinds of adventures, and finally, when he does come back to his own true love, she is very old and used up and ugly, but insists upon him marrying her, and Candide just can not understand what he is to do in this world. And he and Dr. Pangloss and a wise old woman who turns into a shrew and his true love settle down. And the conclusion of Candide is that we must not philosophize anymore. We must not go into these wonderful digressions of meaning anymore. We must, as he said, "'Tis well," said Candide, "but we must cultivate our gardens." And so the telling phrase in Candide is that we must cultivate our gardens, which means stay in an area that we know. But Voltaire is also saying to understand every aspect of that garden. In fact, at Ferney, his wonderful chateau had a tremendous series of gardens, as did Frederick II. And what these were ordered rows of trees and geometric walks, and they were to be a template for the new kind of philosophizing. Instead of wandering by the stream, as Socrates had done in ancient Greece, in sort of a free form, now sentimental excursion, we were now to follow certain rules of development, certain geometries of mathematical precision, and we would arrive at further solutions in this way. Voltaire, at this time, begins to write a number of penetrating works, aside from Candide and Zadig. He writes a short work called Micromegas, which places man in the universe. And at the same time, as he is writing this first almost science fiction type of a writing, his relationship of 15 years with Madame du Châtelet comes to an end. It turns out that she had had an affair on the side with a French poet named Saint Lambert. She was pregnant from this and died in childbirth. Voltaire, crushed by this tragedy, retires to his villa, to his mansion alone, and wandering the empty hallways for months on end, tries to position himself and find sustenance in what he has always proclaimed. And so we find, after 1750, a new Voltaire coming up. In the last 28 years of Voltaire's life, we find him increasingly concerned with the civilization of man, with the large spread of possibilities of man. And of course, Voltaire, living till 1778, lives to see the beginnings of the American Revolution. Frederick the Great was first corresponded to by Voltaire in 1736, and he wrote this opening paragraph to the monarch. "I should indeed be insensitive were I not infinitely touched by the letter with which your Royal Highness has been graciously pleased to honor me. My self-love was but too flattered, but that love of the human race which has always existed in my heart, and which I dare to say determines my character, gave me a pleasure 1,000 times purer when I saw that the world holds a prince who thinks like a man, a philosophic prince who will make men happy." And so he cultivates a lifelong friendship. In 1771, he writes in this way to Frederick: "Great prophet, you resemble your predecessor sent by the Most High. You perform miracles. I owe my life to you. I was dying in the midst of the Swiss snows when your sacred vision was brought to me. As I read, my head freed itself, my blood circulated, my soul revived. After the second page, I regained my strength, and owing to the singular effect of this celestial medicine, it gave me back my appetite and disgusted me with all other food. The Eternal of old ordered your predecessor Ezekiel to eat a parchment book. I should gladly have eaten your paper had I not preferred 100 times to reread it. Yes, you are the only prophet of Jehovah, since you are the only one who has told the truth and laughed at all his comrades. Therefore, Jehovah has blessed you by strengthening your throne, sharpening your pen, and illuminating your soul." Voltaire will keep correspondence till the end of his life with Frederick the Great. In these letters, again and again, we find Voltaire trying to raise the quality of the mind, of the Enlightenment, to a universal level. He becomes increasingly wary of the fact that all this could be seen as a temporary fad, that all these developments could be lost unless they penetrate through to the very structural change of society. And in urging this structural change, Voltaire becomes the man who really lights the fuses of the revolutions. It is the mind of Voltaire, inspired by the mind of Newton, that lays the groundwork for the age of revolution. And all of the other figures that we have in the course that we're looking at will increasingly come to the same conclusion as Voltaire, that in order to ensure this new quality in man, we have to actually live this life. We have to not only believe in this mind, but educate it and develop it, nourish it. And we must return again and again for our substance, for our rules to science. In this emphasis, religion becomes, for Voltaire, as it was called in the Enlightenment, deism. Yes, there is a divine. We do not know precisely what it is yet. We will know, and when we know, we will know precisely what it is. And so deism becomes the religion of the Enlightenment. Thomas Jefferson becomes a deist. Benjamin Franklin will become a deist. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, many of the individuals that we will get into, will come into this. Voltaire becomes then the knight errant of the Enlightenment mind, bringing a sense of mystery no longer hidden, but mystery yet to be uncovered by man, so that the adventure of life becomes increasingly the discovery of the fruits of nature, the fruits of the mind, rather than the covering up and the hiding of sacred initiatory rites which had only balled man up into mud balls. And so the sense of mystery undergoes a sea change. It is no longer what is hidden by habit that is sacred. It is what is being revealed from the hidden nature that is sacred. And as man's mind exfoliates, he becomes closer and closer to that possibility of the free man. That is to say, Voltaire will insist, we have not yet seen man whole. He is still a fledgling. He has been kept in nests of myth and bad habit all this time. We really don't know what he's going to look like, but our duty is to hatch him and get him born into the world and get his wings unfolded. It is only then that we will be able to understand what man really is and what his career is to be. In this tone, Voltaire gives us a tremendous sense of responsibility that he engendered in an essay on the manners and spirits of nations towards the end of his life. He wrote, I have now gone through the immense scene of revolutions that the world has experienced since the time of Charlemagne. And to what have they all tended? To desolation and the loss of millions of lives. Every great event has been a capital misfortune. History has kept no account of times of peace and tranquility. It relates only ravages and disasters. We have beheld our Europe overspread with barbarians after the fall of the Roman Empire. And these barbarians, after becoming Christians, continually at war with the Mohammedans or else destroying each other. We have seen Italy desolated by perpetual wars between city and city. And he goes on to say, all the great states of Christendom have suffered equally by wars and intestine commotions, but none of them has been brought under subjugation to a neighboring power. The result of these endless disturbances and perpetual jars has been only the separating of small provinces from one state to be transferred to another. He says all of this blood and chaos is due to darkness and ignorance, and that in fact we have before us a great responsibility, he says. We must restore man to his rightful place in the world. And the only way we may do this is to free man, because only when he becomes himself will he engender the kind of environment, the kind of civilization that he requires, that a free human society, unknown, is a promise for the future. Well, that's all that we have for tonight. We'll go on with this, of course, next week.